Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Welcome to Rich Answers, a public affairs program of the Conference of Churches and a production of the 224 Ecospace, where changemakers work, create, and lead. Today we are fortunate to have with us Dr. Joel Lohr, who serves as the new president of Harford Seminary since July of 2018. With roots going back to 1834, Harford Seminary is a non-denominational graduate school for religious and theological studies. What makes it unique is its multi-faith environment and proven ability to prepare leaders for the complex world. Welcome.
Good morning.
Glad to have you here. So we want to get a little background and get an understanding of who you are since you're here in Hartford now. Share with us the story of where you were born and who God selected to be your parents.
That's a great way of putting it. So I was born in Canada in a small rural town in Ontario. And my parents were Dutch immigrants. Both were born in Holland, and Archie and Ann Lohr. And part of my why I do what I do today is linked into that little place in Ontario, the rural, fairly monochrome country town called Dunville, Ontario, not far from Niagara Falls and Welland and Hamilton, if you know anything about that area. And I say monochrome because my experience is linked into my parents' decision early in my life to take in children, adopted children of orphans in many respects. So two from Laos, two from Bangladesh. And so that kind of colored, to use that language, really brought life and color into our family home in a place that was quite white and rural. And so that's where I'm from, and those are my parents. And I can say more about the religious background, which was a large part the impetus for that.
So talk about that.
Sure. So the Christian Reformed denomination, it's a Calvinist group, a lot of respect for the Calvinist Reformation, or the Reformation that started by Luther and eventually John Calvin in Geneva. And so the Dutch Reformed, some people call them, the official denomination I grew up was in the Christian Reformed Church of North America. They have their headquarters in Grand Rapids, which for many Dutch people is like the religious or holy land for them. And that was true of my upbringing. And yet my parents, I think some of my own story is wrapped up in their own struggles religiously around that identity as Dutch Reformed Calvinists. And my father in particular, his encounter with a different type of Christianity, a more evangelical Christianity, a Billy Graham Christianity. He had experiences in Billy Graham crusades and had a very deep sort of religious experience with that. And so that kind of colored our experience in a place where Calvinist ideas around being chosen or having, there wasn't a big missionary effort on the part of Calvinists. There was a big emphasis on being chosen into this family or being blessed into a family. And yet my father's own experience of the Billy Graham experience of giving one's life to Jesus, this was not Calvinist language. You know, I have decided to follow Jesus, if you know the old hymn, the old
right.
song. This was actually, it's a funny story, at our wedding, the pianist played I Have Decided to Follow Jesus in the, you know, the opening piano music, the sort of prelude. And I remember looking over at the pastor and said, who approved the Arminian hymn here as a joke? Because I grew up in a place where Calvinist ways of thinking about faith deeply influenced our religious life, and yet my father and my parents were wrestling with their own sort of encounter with people who are different than the Reformed and the Calvinists.
So how did your parents end up moving from Holland to Canada?
There's quite a bit of immigration that took place in the 1950s after World War II, hope for a better life. My grandfather on my father's side was a carpenter, and he was looking for a new life and probably lost a lot during the war. You know, it was hard times, and so Canada was a place of promise. So my father, when he was young, I believe 7 or 8 years old, in 1949, if my memory is correct, but at any rate, he came as a very young adult or a young child. And then my mother, likewise, she was very young. She was an infant, and her parents likewise came to Canada in the hope of finding work, a new life. Holland was, after the war, I think just didn't provide the opportunities that they wanted. And so there was a lot of hope in coming to North America, and it was quite easy to emigrate at that point. And they did, and there was a large Dutch community. When I say our church was a thriving Christian community, when I grew up in a church with many, many, many pews, and probably 600 people in those pews each week, no one spoke before the service. It was a very quiet, solemn event. In fact, I remember turning around once in church, and an elder or a person in our church, who will remain unnamed, for them, he grabbed me by my ear to set me straight and kind of lifted me out of my chair in the pew because I was fidgeting. It was a place where you were, it was a reverential, people entered the church very early to be prepared, and there was silence. And so that was my church experience. And yet my parents lived out somewhat of a different faith. It was a very pious personal faith. My father was both my parents really valued reading the Bible for one's own life and praying around the dinner table. We had scripture reading, I believe, at least every evening with our dinner. It was part of our upbringing, and just the value of Bible. And so those things are imprinted. I can still, because the Bible was read so much in my childhood, I feel like if someone quotes something from scripture, intuitively I can remember, I don't know if that's in the Bible. I think that's a misquote, or at least I can kind of tell, it's familiar. I might not be able to do chapter and verse, but I feel like it's kind of in my head because it's been read to me so many times.
And what called your parents to adopt?
Well, then we talked about my father and my mother. It was really my mother. She had a very deep interest in helping what I would call the sort of those on the margins. She's the sort of person to this day who, if you're at a wedding and there's the person who doesn't look like they fit in, maybe they're covered in tattoos and no one else is, or they've got all the piercings, my mother's the sort of person to go and sit down and say, "Hi, how are you? Who are you? And it's great to have you here." And so her own, she would probably be reluctant to describe it as a deeply religious impulse, but I think it stems from her love for doing the right thing and for the stranger, for the outsider. And so she was just the sort of person who got involved. And when many of her siblings as well adopted children, and I think they... there were opportunities in that time, children coming from Laos, children from Bangladesh that were orphaned. It was much easier to adopt in those times. There were people who were bringing orphans into Canada to try to home them and help them live. And when the opportunities came up, many in her family, her siblings, as well as my mother, said, "We can take a child, absolutely." And you may have noticed when I walked in, I'm a very tall person, 6'8", actually.
Almost bumping your head on the door, yes.
Yes, I do duck. I'm very cautious of objects that can hurt. And my mother decided, after having my brother and I, who are quite large babies, that she would adopt instead of having her own anymore, if that makes any sense.
I understand. God bless your mother. And so think back to your childhood. How did God present to you a relationship? How, as a child, did you come to know God for yourself? Think about some of those early memories.
Probably because of this tension between choosing, on the one hand, this idea, what we used to talk about as Arminian theology, this idea that we make decisions to follow Jesus, and then the tension of that with this Calvinist worldview that you're born into or blessed into a family of God, and it's really, you're part of that family. You may not choose to be part of it, but you can always choose to leave that family. But I was sort of, I always understood myself as a person of faith, or at least a Christian or a follower of Jesus, because I was never had anything that would suggest otherwise. And so the idea of later in life, it's this idea of confirming later in life. You confirm that which has been kind of given to you, or we also had something called profession of faith, but you make a profession of that faith. So my faith, I remember attending Baptist churches and other churches as an early adult and finding it kind of confusing when I'd hear a parent say, "Well, we sure hope our child accepts Jesus one day." And I remember thinking, well, they just sang Jesus Loves Me, and, they seem to be Christian or walking with God or have a faith in Jesus. what has to happen yet? I don't get it. You know, it was kind of a new experience to experience that. So even though my father had these experiences, we still had kind of a sense that we were always people of faith, and it wasn't forced on us. I would say it was a healthy environment, and my parents, for all of their deep faith, I think they weren't, what's the word, oppressive about their sort of, I think for them, they also went through their own struggles in their marriage, and my parents are not together anymore, and I think that happened early in my life, and that's also a big part of my story. I think my life has been trying to figure out both the unchosen, the outsider, and in conjunction with broken relationships in our own family, and so we had this deep sense of wanting to care for the outsider or the stranger or the what I call the unchosen. I ended up doing my PhD on this, looking at this topic. So those questions, what does it mean to be an outsider? You think about raising or being in a family with children of color in a place where that's not the norm, and to see that unfold as a child and to be kind of so committed to my siblings. We weren't allowed to talk about adopted siblings. They were just siblings. This was our family. So those questions were deeply intermeshed with my own hardship in life, which was seeing our parents go through a divorce. And so I think my life has really been about trying to figure those two things out. Try to figure out what does it mean to care for those on the margins and to care for the stranger. And how do we help bring reconciliation to people who are divorced or apart? And so my work at Hartford Seminary in many ways is an outworking of that. Not that we need to get into that necessarily, or we can at some point, but the tension that we see in life, I think at one point in my career I was asked to pick the one word that sums up who you are. This was kind of this, I worked at University of the Pacific, they called it the one word project. What's your one word? And for 6 years I resisted because I thought, I can't sum up who I am in one word. You know, I'm not doing that. And all the directors had to give their one word, and I was the lone holdout, and there was always that spot on the wall where it should have been me up there, and I just wouldn't define it. But when I left, somehow I felt free to say, I think my one word might be reconciliation or mediation or mediator, and I don't use those words lightly. I just think that the idea of helping people who are otherwise apart come to see what they have in common, the common humanity that we share even in our differences, and that's a really important part. It's not about minimizing difference or acting as if those differences don't exist, which is why Hartford Seminary is such a great place. The tagline is exploring differences, deepening faith, and so it's really a calling and a life fulfillment to be at a place that does this.
We're talking with Dr. Joel Lohr, who's the president of Hartford Seminary, and we'll be back after the break.
Your ghost, lonely and dreaming of the West Coast. I don't want to be your downtown. I don't want to be your stupid game with my big black boots and an old suitcase. I do believe I'll find myself a new place. I don't. Of your face, hungry and hollow.
Neverland.
Dr. Joel Lohr, who is the president of Hartford Seminary. So in the first segment, we were talking about your childhood formation of faith and understanding. How did God give you your call to ministry?
It's interesting. You know, the call to ministry came as an early adult. So I often say this, and it's true. Never in my early childhood years did my parents talk about college. To my memory, I don't recall the word college ever said in our home or university, unless it was in reference to Calvin College in Grand Rapids because someone maybe was there. But the idea of going to college was not on our radar. And to this day, I'm one of the few people, at least in my original family, we have six children in our at least in our unit before my parents split. I think I'm the only person that has gone to college or gotten a college degree. So first in family and. And I say that because it wasn't part of the landscape. My father was a carpenter. His father was a carpenter. They don't have high education levels, and yet they're incredibly intelligent and thoughtful, wise people. But education, going to college, was not on the radar. So I didn't have that opportunity that so many people have today, and it's kind of an expectation that you're going to go to college and kind of explore and learn or get a career. For me, it was become a carpenter. And so that's what I did. When I got out of high school, I enrolled in an apprenticeship program and did a what they now call a journey person apprenticeship, a journeyman carpenter program. I did that for 4 years and enjoyed it immensely. Worked in construction management as part of that and near the end of that time. And while I was doing that, I remember thinking to myself, I was very interested in theological ideas, still wrestling with these Calvinist ideas of what does it mean to be chosen. And I remember attending at this point, I was in a church in Hamilton, an evangelical church, and the youth pastor was just quite perplexed by me reading Calvin's Institutes, this massive theological work that he said, we had to read that in seminary. It was awful. Why are you reading this for fun? And I remember just having these questions about theology, and it was really him that he came alongside me and said, man, if you're going to throw your life away if you don't do something with this, you know. And I came to realize that the construction would go on without me, but I really needed to explore this option of looking more into or I felt this call, I guess. You know, we use that language of call. I sensed that God was moving in a way that I should do something with it and study and not waste the opportunity. I was still young enough to make a change, although today we make many career changes. It's never too late. And so this will give you a sense of how my educational background. I decided I needed to go to seminary because my call was, as all calls are when you're in an evangelical church, you become a pastor. At least that's the limited understanding I had. That's what you do. You become a minister, a pastor, in Dutch, the domine. And so I called a seminary in Florida, a Reformed seminary. I think it even has Reformed in the name. And I called it and said, I'd like to come to seminary. I'm going to become a pastor. And they said, okay, that's great. We'll send you the information before internet. We'll send you the application form and the please send in your application. It should have a letter of, you know, your call or some kind of explanation of that, as well as your transcripts. And you send it all in. We'll look at it. And I said, what are transcripts? And I said, transcripts for your BA. And I said, what's a BA?
Okay.
They said, what's... I said, a BA, your undergrad. You need to have an undergrad degree before you can come to graduate school. This is a seminary. It's a graduate school. I said, oh, well, I guess I have to get one of those. And so, didn't even know what a BA was. And I remember being in the basement of the church, the same church where I was at, and I talked to some elder at the church. You know, this probably wasn't that old, but at that point, when you're 20, they seem old. But he said, well, it's either Wheaton College or Trinity Western. That's where you need to go. And I took that as gospel truth, and I applied to both, and ended up applying to Wheaton College, applying to Trinity Western, which is a small Christian university. It's the largest university, Christian private university in Canada, and ended up going to Trinity Western in near Vancouver, British Columbia. And that world opened up. There was a really exciting time when I got to Trinity Western because I was studying text critically. I was learning informal logic and formal logic, symbolic logic, philosophy really engaged me. I really took a deep interest in those things. And the world of learning opened up for me in ways that I never really anticipated. And I came to realize that there was more to my call than necessarily becoming a pastor. And actually, it was my professors, one in particular, but two, who came alongside me and convinced me that I should consider not doing the traditional route, but maybe think about doing a PhD while I'm at it, because I was doing well in school. My grades were, I just applied myself and did well. And so they encouraged me to do a PhD and had a lot of questions. And I thought it might be interesting to research some questions around this idea of the stranger, the chosen, the outsider. And the idea of election is typically how theologians talk about that, God's choosing of people. And so ended up doing a PhD. I went to University of Durham in England and spent 5 years of my life there. I was recently married and spent some great time there. And I was so out of my depth, at least I felt that way. You know, imposter syndrome is very real, and I think many of us struggle with it, and we may not always acknowledge it or realize that's what's happening, but I felt like I was out of my depth. And with these very, you know, Oxford, Cambridge trained, Durham is the third oldest university in the UK after Oxford and Cambridge, and it will remind you of that very often, and it's a place where people are sharp thinkers. It's one of the world's top 50 universities, probably. So it was a scary place for a young, you know, wet behind the ears theologian, you know, new to university, carpenter, trying to do everything he could to survive.
Carpenter who also likes Metallica. So
yeah,
we talked about that during the break. And so while clearly you have been a person inspired by faith, you were trained as a carpenter, so you know what it is to work with everyday people. You've had this experience of diversity within your own family. How did the weaving of the music of, like, Metallica show up in your life, in addition to which formed you for the person that you are today?
You ask such good questions, because
thank you.
The way you frame that, how did Metallica come into your life? I was going to pontificate a little about Metallica, but I'm going to do the same maybe through a story.
Okay.
And so my early years as a high school student, Metallica was sort of there, and I was trying to find my way. As I mentioned earlier, the family life was tough, and music appealed to me, and I found myself interested in heavy metal for some reason. I was a skateboarder first, and then heavy metal came into my world, and before I knew it, I was talking to people about, you know, what's this album I see, Master of Puppets and Justice for All, and then I ended up, you know, going through the entire discography of Metallica. And it came to be very important to me. And yet, to kind of go quickly through the stages, when I felt this call to ministry, I felt this deep sense that this heavy metal in my life, and to be honest, there are other bands there like Slayer and Megadeth, and which I felt like there was a conflict between this music and my life as a person of faith. And some of the themes, certainly in a band like Slayer, are pretty dark. And if not, they've been accused of being Satanist, although the lead singer of Slayer is a Catholic. And with Metallica, it always felt like there was something more in that music. If you look at the lyrics of many of their songs, maybe not the first album, Kill 'Em All, but the other albums, it's really, some people call it thinking man's metal or thinking person's metal. The lyrics are about relationships. They're about the struggles of abuse and substance abuse, forgiveness. And at any rate, so I gave up Metallica for so many years. And to answer your question, how did they come to be part of my life again, or how is it that I'm still listening to this music as a pretty devout, or at least I'm not, maybe devout's the wrong word, but I'm figuring out faith, and it's important to me, and I think it has great importance for our world. Why would I listen to Metallica? And although Metallica
is the president of Harvard
Seminary, it came back to me at a time when I went through some health things when I was in England doing my PhD, and I went through 5 months of chemotherapy and 2 months of radiation, and it was in those moments where I found myself drawn to two things: the laments of the Psalter, the Psalms of the Bible, Psalm 13, Psalm 6. And I found myself wanting to go back to some of those cries from Metallica. And I came to realize that God was okay with that. And I came to see that some of the laments of Metallica, some of the themes of their songs, you know, the Unforgiven song, the Unforgiven 2, actually the Unforgiven 3, all three of those, the trilogy of those songs are powerful, the lyrics and the music in particular, and the weaving of those two things. And then also the laments, I think the deep cry for feeling, where are you, O God? You know, those songs in my feeling of hopelessness in that moment of being unwell and seeing my life and seeing it, there was something redemptive in the music of Metallica that to this day still empowers me, or at least gives me hope in the ways that I think lament can give us hope in the psalm and Psalter.
We're talking with Dr. Joel Lohr, who's the president of Harford Seminary, and we'll be back after the break. Have been listening to Rich Answers, a public affairs program of the Conference of Churches.
Your burdens, brought your pain, but I have a message for you today, that when you leave here, it won't be the same. So you tell me, you've been to your physician, but look at you, there's been no change in your condition. Reach out and touch the Master's robe. There's healing for your mind, your body, and all your soul. Yes, there is. Hallelujah. God can heal.
God can heal.
Oh, yeah.
He can heal.
And he can mend and broken.
He can mend your brokenness.
Oh, yes, you will. Thank you, Lord. God knows about your situation, but with every test and every trial, there is revelation. conviction that God is able to supply every one of your needs. He's here to touch and heal you. Oh, he'll set you free. Yes, he will. God, you promised me. Said he would. That you'll have your healing. Once God works a miracle to fit your needs, go tell the Lord, oh, what you have received. Hallelujah. And then my
let God have it.
see
what happened. When I stopped looking at back then,
when I let go,
I let go.
When I let God, let Him have
His way.
There's so much going on. Sometimes I can't find my way, and oftentimes I struggle from day to day. I have to realize that it's not my battle, it's not my battle to fight. I have to know if I put it in your hands, everything will be alright. As soon as I stop worrying
how the story ends,
I can let go. Let God, let go, and let God, let go, let God, oh, let go, and let God, let go, and let God, my brother, let go, and let God, my sister, you can't handle it, let God.
Who's the president of Hartford Seminary. So tell us about how all of these experiences have been woven together to create you as this leader of Hartford Seminary. And as you answer that question, also give us a sense of what Hartford Seminary is.
Thank you. It's a great segue into why I do what I do each day, which occupies a lot of my time and energy because I care so deeply about it. And I think the point that, you know, you said leader, I'm going to just rephrase that and say it is the language we use. We even talk about being the leader in interfaith graduate education, raising leaders for this world, which are so desperately needed. And yet I think of myself as a servant, not necessarily a leader. I think we are trying to help our graduates learn something about servanthood, maybe servant leadership, to use that language, which has been used often. But that's a deeply important theme to us at the seminary, and to me is the servant, or the servant in chief, or chief servant leader, whatever. How did I come to Hartford Seminary? I did not have intentions to move to Connecticut to serve at Hartford Seminary. We were living in California, and I was working at University of the Pacific, and I quite enjoyed my work there. I was Dean of Religious Life and Associate Professor there. And it's part of my journey is that I've encountered really interesting people as part of my studies. And one of the interesting people I've met is a professor of Judaism at a local college here, not far away from here, within an hour of the seminary. And he pointed me to this job and said, "Have you considered Hartford Seminary? They're looking for a president. You could probably do that job really, really well, knowing your interests." And I said, I know Hartford Seminary because I used to do book reviews. One of the dean here used to be the book review editor, and I knew something about the seminary because of people who worked here. But I hadn't taken, you know, there are lots of seminaries in the country. It's Hartford. You know, what do you know about Connecticut? Not a lot. And so he said, you should apply for it. I said, I'm not going to apply for it. They're not going to look at me. I'm a pretty young guy. I thought, you know, early career, to use the politically correct way of putting that. I didn't know whether they'd be interested in someone in their 40s to be heading up a place like that. And he said, well, I'm going to put your name and I'll nominate you. And I had nothing to lose going in. I thought, I'm not needing to move. I'm not looking to leave where I'm working. We were enjoying our life in California. The weather was great. There's a lot of things about living there that we enjoy. And we gave up to come here. But on the other hand, when they started interviewing me for the position, I came to see how deeply this place ties into my own interest as a person who is, to get to those earlier things we talked about, difference, dialoguing about difference. One of the key things we do at the seminary is dialogue. I think it's one of our strengths. Exploring differences, deepening faith, to go back to that tagline that's on our logo, that we are not going to minimize difference. We see difference as what makes this world beautiful. Religious difference, not only religious difference, but all the many ways that we are diverse people. We are committed to exploring those with honesty, integrity, with respect for what makes us unique as a Christian. I don't pretend that I'm the same as a Jew or the same as a Muslim or religious person in general. I think we have lots of commonalities, which we also talk about and are hugely important to our work. And we can find areas of overlap and focus that can help us work together. And yet I also feel very strongly that it's in understanding each other that we come to understand ourselves more fully. And it goes way back to ideas of people, I think it's Socrates who said, know thyself, the real goal in life is to come to know who you are, who we are as individuals, so that we can, when we are healthy and know who we are, we're able to help others. And so Hartford Seminary is a unique institution. It is that we have a diverse student population like we do. We've historic relationship with Muslim-Christian relations. Back in 1800s, 1893, there's as a Christian seminary decided it was important to study Arabic and Islam in order to understand those places. Earlier, it was about going to places in the world for mission work. When we think about mission work, we often think about conversion and making people, trying to convince people to become Christian. And yet Hartford Seminary, in its time, that's part of its history, and yet it came to understand that conversion might also be thought of as conversation, or maybe move away from conversion and move to conversation and to take seriously the people that they were going to meet in those places, and to take seriously Islam so that we can understand it better and respect the people that we are coming to encounter. And so Muslim-Christian relations is a hugely important part of our work and deeply enriches our experiences. Roughly 38%, I believe, this year of our students are Muslim, doing Islamic chaplaincy programs, studies in Islamic studies. We have Christian studies, a Jewish studies program, and we do focus on the Abrahamic faiths, although we are also doing a broader religious curriculum. We do think it's important that you understand beyond those three to understand something about world religions. And so there's more I can say, but that maybe gives you something to go with.
And so when you think about your role as servant leader at Hartford Seminary and the world that we live in today, why is there a need for Hartford Seminary in these times?
I'm smiling.
That was a leading question.
That's a very leading
question. I'm an alum also.
Yes, that's right. You're an alum. It's good to have you interview me. You're a great example of what the people we're producing or that we're honored to have come to us. I often think, people think of seminary as a place, and even its name is this idea of planting seeds. And I always think people come with their own seeds. They come with their own lives, and we're just part of a journey of nourishing those and planting more and learning from our students. The question was,
why do we need
Hartford Seminary in today's world? And I smiled when you're asking that question, because I think we can disagree on a lot in this world, but I think we can agree that, especially in our this country, we are not talking to each other in the ways, best practice. You think about best practice in medicine, best practice in business, best practice in so many places. I don't know that we're engaging in best practice when it comes to our politics, when it comes to how we engage each other around social issues, race. You just look at how the polarization in our technology is not helping for all of its promises and for all of the ways technology has helped us live better and more comfortable lives and have really, you know, technology has been so important, and yet it's also exacerbating problems and it's polarizing us in certain ways. And so, you know, I think we're coming to a period in our lives with our technology where some of us at least are asking the questions, how is this helping me become a better person or a better country? And what do we need to be doing? You know, we've just kind of taken it in because we can and we're using it. And I think we need to be really careful. I'm not the Luddite who's saying no more technology, but how is this technology? How does our social media, how does the way that whatever we think about fake news, there's something going on in our the way that we're presenting ideas and information that is not bringing us closer together. And so is there a need for Hartford Seminary? Absolutely. I think that the model that we are teaching and that we live out each day, humbly trying to figure this out, I think we've learned some things about trying to talk to people who are different. Historically, religious people have fought each other, are not getting along. They feel polarized in their beliefs. They're trying to convert each other. And we're learning that if we can set aside some of those things and engage each other as fellow human beings, that regardless of our religious families, we are all part of the same human family. We share so much. We're all created in God's image. Even if that's not the language you use, we are God's creatures. And I think if we can get some, if we can share the lessons we're learning in religious dialogue, just think of Protestants and Catholics and the history of them being able to not being able to talk to each other and where we've come. If you think of Muslim-Christian relations and where we are finally getting some traction and learning that we can talk to each other, if we can share some of those stories, Jewish-Christian relations, we're still seeing there's still need there for dialogue because of some of the, you know, we saw again just recently another shooting in the Halle synagogue in Germany. But if we can teach some of those lessons, I think we have something to offer the world, this polarized world, people who can't talk to each other. Can we teach some of the lessons we've learned in religious dialogue?
And talk about the Peacemakers program.
Thank you. That's our flagship program. It is an opportunity where we are intentional about bringing in individuals from around the world, students, young, typically young, although we do have had a diverse age as well. But these are going to be hopefully the leaders in their society. So we bring in students from around the world. We currently have students from Myanmar and Indonesia, India. We've brought in students from around Middle East, Africa. We have a student this year from Nigeria. These are students who are coming to us to learn and engage in peace-building skills and take that home to their home place, or home countries and places of work. And we also have typically one domestic student as well. It's a fully funded program, tuition, housing. It's our flagship program that we think is going to be a model elsewhere. And the reason it's successful is because we are intentional about who we bring in from around the world, that we do make it free. We can't charge tuition. It needs to, and this is where we need people's support. If you meet these leaders, we talk a lot about Hartford Seminary. You should really be interviewing them because they are the story of Hartford Seminary. When I bring them with me to tell their story and what they've learned and how Hartford Seminary has helped them become a better leader. I have students who come from places like Indonesia and say, I've never been in a synagogue before, and they learn, you know, they have an experience here and they learn how to talk to someone who's different and bring that home to their home country. And, you know, some people would say we're better known in Indonesia than we are in Hartford, and that's actually probably true and kind of sad. But this International Peacemakers Program really is a defining program for us.
And there's wonderful opportunities for people at a variety of levels, places. There's the Women's Leadership Program. Mm-hmm. We have the Black Ministries Program.
Hugely
there's
important.
The graduate program, master's level program, the PhD program.
Doctor of Ministries.
So there's all kinds of opportunities for people at Hartford Seminary. So if someone wanted to explore Hartford Seminary, how do they find out more?
The typical ways, you go to online, heartsem.edu is our webpage. You'll find a lot of information there. I'd encourage you to take a look or find us on Facebook and see some of their Facebook as well, stocked with stories and examples of the things we're doing. Look at our faculty, meet some of our professors. There are testimonials from students on our webpages. You can also come visit us. We're right here in Hartford. We're just in the west end of the city, in a big white building, which you cannot miss. If you have an opportunity, if you get on our newsletter, you can always unsubscribe if you don't want to keep getting the mail, but it's usually once or twice a week, or every other week or every week. We send newsletters depending on the time of year, if we're in semester or not. And you can learn about events. We have a lot of public events, lectures, engaging speakers. Come to a lecture. Maybe audit a course. We have a lot of interesting courses. You don't need to take a course for a degree. You could audit it. You could even take it for a few weeks and decide, I think I want to take this as a course. And so, yeah, our website would be the place to begin.
Dr. Joel Lohr, we thank you for your service at Harvest Seminary and your ministry.
30,000 square feet. What would you do with that kind of possibility? Would you strategize your future? Or get lost in the past? Will you fill it with stories? Or use it to empty your mind? Would you explore your spirituality? Or focus on improving your community? Will you use it to work late? Or just work it? Could you create lasting impressions? Or a brief, delicious one? Our vision for the 224? 30,000 square feet of endless possibilities.
In the small town of Elmira, New York, a boy was born into an all-American family. The odds of him opening his own clothing store at the age of 18? 1 in 138,000. Excited to be a part of pop culture, he packed for the big city. The odds of finding someone to invest in his vision? 1 in 4.5 million. The odds of him achieving his dream in the fashion industry? 1 in 23 million. The odds of having a child diagnosed with autism? 1 in 88. I am Tommy Hilfiger, and my family is affected by autism. I encourage you to learn more at autismspeaks.org/signs. Early diagnosis can make a lifetime of difference. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
Peek-a-boo. Peek-a-boo. Smile.
Smile, buddy.
Come on. Smile. Oh, honey. He's still not smiling.
Maybe he's not a smiler.
Yeah. Maybe he's just not a happy baby.
Maybe he's just being a boy. You know how boys are.
Or maybe he's teething. Oh, poor baby. I think his gums hurt.
Maybe he's just tired.
Or maybe his tummy hurts. He didn't eat that much.
Maybe he's not ticklish.
You think maybe he's scared of the dog?
Maybe he'll outgrow it. Maybe it's a phase. Maybe he just doesn't like smiling.
Maybe he has autism, and we can definitely do something to help.
Maybe is all you need to find out more about autism. No Big Joyful Smiles by 6 months is one early sign. Learn the others at autismspeaks.org/signs or see a doctor today for an autism screening. The sooner it's diagnosed, the better. And it can make a lifetime of difference. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
You have been listening to Rich Answers, a public affairs program of the Conference of Churches and a production of the 224 Ecospace. Reach out to us and tell us what you think. Look for Rich Answers, the Conference of Churches, and me, Reverend Dr. Shelley Bess, on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Like us, follow us, share us.